all these people saying, we did all these things in your name. It's like people today. I recite the creed. I said the sinner's prayer. I go to church. I speak in tongues. I cast out demons. And Jesus says, yeah, it would have been nice if you would have loved your enemy.
Man, has it been a year already when we talked to Brian McLaren as he answered the question, why does Jesus sound so harsh? Giving us some cultural context on a lot of words that came out of Jesus' mouth that quite frankly just sounded mean. Not in congruence with love your enemies and Father forgive them. And I really enjoyed that conversation. I put the link in the show notes if you want to go back and listen to that one. And oh yeah, he came back on the show about 6 months later on episode 273 to talk about his book, Faith After Doubt. I'm reading that book right now. It's a dandy of a book. That's a dandy of a man. And I really do love the guy a whole lot. So I've been listening to a lot of podcasts lately, and I really am curious about something. I don't think there's any way to know the answer to this question, but there's just, you just do this as a podcaster. It's something you just do. It's like saying the Pledge of Allegiance before school starts. Hey, please go to iTunes and leave a rating if you enjoy this podcast. It helps me a great deal. Leave a comment, that sort of thing. And I really do wonder how effective it is. Like, how many people hear those instructions and then follow accordingly? It really must depend on your Enneagram number. I bet you it does. Very happy to report that our listenership did it once again. We have a monthly giving opportunity through donorseed.com/PWNA helps. It's our own link to our own opportunity for this podcast. And we just helped a classroom full of students get an education by buying materials for their class. It was a measly $300 for us, and we did it again. If you join our PWNA patrons, half of what you give me goes to Donor C. And if you want all of your money to go towards Donor C and just do it through being a patron, that is fine also. So I am on Instagram, everybody, and the reason I tell you this is because, hey, you know, it's a different kind of family, but we're a family. We're a family of podcast listeners and hosts, and I've got regular guests. And so I want to share the fact that so many people say, dude, you look like Shel Silverstein. He's a famous kids book author. He wrote The Giving Tree. And so I did a side-by-side on Instagram, and it's pretty freaking ridiculous how much we do indeed look like one another. I think it's like 6 or 7 pictures down. Check it out. It's pretty crazy. So this episode, bringing a bunch at you. I hope you enjoy it. I love you. God bless and peace out until next week. Boom. So let me ask you guys this. I was the very first, like, I am, people say woke and all that stuff. I'm not really woke. I'm trying to be woke, just not that woke. So it was probably just a year ago when I heard ableism for the first time, and someone actually on Facebook, it was a friend of mine, someone said something about Biden not a good choice because he is probably losing his mind. And my friend said, that's a very ableist thing of you to say. And the other person responded, yeah, you're right. And I had to look that word up. And I have to say that I think that we are taking this too daggum far. Now, here's some things that I found online that I can totally get with. Ableism, discriminating against them for speaking about their diagnosis and challenges or accusing them of just wanting attention or trying to manipulate others. Another one that I could get with, saying they should just get over it or accept it without recognizing the immense grief that can come from chronic illness or disability. Where I draw a line is when we start to try to change how language has always worked. So what I mean by that is right now, and I'm gonna say it, right now the word retarded is not acceptable, and that's okay. Our culture got to that point, even though it's a scientific term, our culture has gotten to a place where that's just not acceptable anymore. And if we're kind people that care about people, let's just not say it, because that's our culture sees that word as inappropriate, and I'm fine with that. However, if someone, as someone that struggles with depression sometimes, if someone looks at their grade on their phone, like a kids can do now, and they say, oh my gosh, I got an F, I'm so depressed. That is not offensive to me at all. Now, if there was someone in the, like all the time, if there's someone in the room that says, hey, that's offensive for me when you say that you're depressed because I actually struggle with depression, right away, yes, I'm so sorry for saying that. I did not mean to offend. So on a case by case, for sure. But couldn't we say there's two ways of using the word depression? One is an illness, a clinical condition. Another way of using it would be it's a figure of speech. And so I actually watched a video of this young woke lady that was addressing this and giving all sorts of examples, and I was actually stunned. So, for example, she said, you should not say, oh my gosh, like I can't concentrate, I have ADD. Don't say that. Ableism. Or how about this one? Oh my gosh, are you blind? You didn't see that? Don't say that. Ableist comment about blind people. I stuff myself. Oh man, I'm going to get fat. Don't say that. Ableism about fat people. And I don't know. I really do feel like we are getting to a point where we don't even care about the heart of a person or the intent of their words. Like I've tried to tell my kids, for instance, I don't really care about cuss words. I don't want you saying them as a kid right now because that's inappropriate. And as you grow up, I want you to always be respectful. That's your number one goal. There's no difference in the word poop and shit. But if you're around your grandmother, you don't say shit because that pisses your grandma off and she finds that disrespectful and not appropriate. But there's no difference between those two words. And I just feel like we're doing the same thing with this ableism stuff. And I'm curious what you guys think. Well, do I sound like a horrible Southern boy?
No, but
I have a Confederate flag and everything also.
The difference between saying shit and retarded is nobody is like going to be.
No, I don't support retarded. I don't support that word.
Just wanted to make sure as we were throwing those all together.
Right. Do you understand what I'm saying? Like that word has become inappropriate. Let's get with the culture and accept that by and large, that's inappropriate. I don't find it appropriate for someone to say, oh, I got an F. I'm so depressed. This sucks. That doesn't offend me.
It doesn't offend you, but it might offend someone else, you know? Like someone could say, oh, it doesn't bother me when a white person says the N-word.
Don't you think though that we are getting into this territory where we are looking for things to be offended about?
No, I don't. I think that people, and not you in general, but a little bit you, are like, well, I want to still be able to say that. And it's like, why do you want it so bad? Why do you want to call, well, I'm not going to say.
Well, here's the thing, Ellen, is I'm fine. That's I accept that analysis, but I don't feel that it's super accurate because I'll give it all up. I don't care. What I don't like is when someone is just trying to have a meaningful conversation online and they say something about, I hit the return button too early. I have ADD, and then gets just lambasted by everybody saying you're an ableist. Cancel culture.
That's too far.
That person sucks.
That's too far.
So like in the case of words like retarded or like the N-word, there are words where, you know, as a culture, we have sort of decided, hey, these are not okay. And I think that like cultures need to be able to do that. One of my deals about, like taking down Confederate memorials is like, listen, every culture and, you know, every time period should be able to decide for itself who they want to honor, who they want to reject. Like that is a thing that, you know, it's not like one generation gets to decide who is venerable and then everyone else is like, well,
forever.
Every culture and every country needs to be able to assess themselves and decide, hey, this is something we want to change about ourselves. And language is a part of that because language is very powerful. Where I do think there is a distinction, though, is are we agreeing on this as a culture? Or are there voices that are just louder than everyone else's saying, hey, these things are not okay? It's fine for those voices to say, hey, these things are not okay, as long as we can then talk about, that's interesting. Is this okay? And actually decide, like, together what's okay and what's not. Because one of the things I think is unfortunate is there's a Pakistani journalist that I really like. He's an American who actually grew up in the South. And one of his things is like, you know, when you guys keep saying, hey, you can't say these things about Muslims, hey, you guys can't say these things, he's like, you're infantilizing us. Like, we're grownups. We can handle these things. Like, stop saying that no one can say these things. And I think that you can do that with words, like with some of the things you're talking about, where it's like, oh, you can't say the word blind, or you can't say ADD. It's like, it doesn't help to treat an entire group of people like they're children who are incapable.
Or like they're all the same.
Yeah, exactly. Right. You know, it's like, that's not especially helpful. If you just sort of assume it's like, hey, listen, this group of people, they can't handle anything that might set them off. That's kind of insulting and patronizing.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think I don't want to ruin your train of thought.
No, not at all.
As we're talking this out, I think that's what bothers me, is the whistleblowing and the demonizing of people that obviously did not have bad intentions. They weren't making fun of blind people. They weren't even necessarily being insensitive. Now, I guess you could get to a point where that's insensitive because you didn't think not to say that. But in the grand scheme of things, if someone says, man, he must have been blind when he hit that car, like, golly, maybe reach out to that person on a one-on-one and have a conversation, but don't gang up on them online. I do want to tell y'all something really funny. I'm sure both of you are aware of Tim Keller. By the way, Ellen, Jack used to be a Driscollite just like me and you. And so he was also a Rob Bellion.
Jack, welcome.
Oh, hey, look. Well, my deal is like, so the three people I loved when I was in, you know, like a college student, was Mark Driscoll, Rob Bell, and Derek Webb. And so it's like,
I don't understand how Rob Bell and Mark Driscoll, you both loved them at the same time.
They, because they were just like this, hey, these communicators that I connected with for different reasons. Like, Rob Bell's like, boy, he's got away with words, and I really identify with the way his mind works. And Mark Driscoll, just sort of like this, boy, this really systematic and, you know, or whatever I thought at the time. It's like this, you know, approach that he has. And there's different things I liked about each of them. And so, yeah, my view now is people should do what I do and don't admire anybody.
I love that.
Y'all listen to this, though. So Tim Keller, you both know this. Jack, did you know that Tim Keller used to go to the Seacoast James Allen campus during the summers? And I didn't even know. I saw this short little ball-headed guy, and he was with like a big guy, I'm assuming.
That's ableist.
Oh, short little ball? Short? Whoa. Short is not a disability.
But Joey, as a reasonably tall person, you can't claim that word for yourself.
That's right.
Oh my gosh.
You can't talk about a whole, you can't broad brush a whole group of people.
I pray y'all are kidding. So anyway, I'm listening to a Tim Keller message, and this cannot be more than 5 or 10 years ago. I'm going to say 5. And I'm really curious if he still is this way. He's going on a list of people. The outcast, I forgot the words, but he literally says, he gets to this and he says, the retarded. So he goes on a list of people that are potentially outcasts and people that we don't pay attention to, the homeless, the retarded. And I was like, he just said that. So here's the thing. Back up a little bit and recognize the generation that he came from, where that's the word that you
use. How old is he? He's in his 70s.
Gotta be. But even when I was in elementary school, that word is what you use for people that had an IQ at a certain level. Like, there's a retarded kid in the class. That's just what you said. Now it sounds horrible, but that is the terminology that was used. And so instead of canceling Tim Keller, which I'm not saying that happened to him, recognize, let's take some context here. I wonder why he uses that word. He seems to be a pretty cool guy. I don't think that he's trying to slander people with a super low IQ. But anyway, it was very shocking to hear because Tim Keller is so intelligent. So, Jack, none of this stuff annoys you? I'm actually surprised.
No, it does annoy me. But I think, like, so, okay, there are always going to be people who are looking to get offended. But I don't think... Here's what I think the like really what's happening with a lot of that stuff, and it's not just that, it's like our, it infects like every bit of our civil discourse right now. And it's like this search for purity. And it, to me, it's like, it has been the weirdest thing to watch a lot of like so many broad swaths of our culture, like reenacting the first several millennia of human religious yearning, right? It's like, wait, there's evil in our midst. We must purge it. How do we purge it? We have to kill someone. And it's like, we've killed this person. The evil's still in our midst. And that's like, that is how I feel about everything on social media, is we found a bad person. We're going to destroy them. This person is destroyed. It's still there. We got to find another person to destroy. And like, I really don't want to get like into like cancel culture and all that stuff, but there is like this sense that, and this is it's not uniquely American, but it is an especially American impulse to realize, like to recognize our failings as a society and to like be desperate to live up to what we think our ideals are. Yeah. And I think that there's a British historian, Paul Johnson, who said that America has this bizarre thing where every few decades we try to commit cultural suicide and we barely like emerge from it. And just kind of like, we have this crisis. And I think that there's just a sense that like there's a very broad sense that we're not living up to our ideals, and all of these different sides of the political spectrum or spiritual ideological spectrum, whatever you want to say, have different views of why that is. But it's just like this, we have to be pure. And so there are words we can't say, and there are things we can't do, and there are people we can't associate with, and every side does it. And it's poison, because it's this pursuit of purity without any kind of mechanism for forgiveness or redemption or grace. And I think that's the thing that you're kind of talking about, where it's like, that is really destructive, is someone screws up. What is the mechanism for them to redeem themselves? There isn't one. They can't apologize enough. They can't explain enough. There's nothing about their past that can justify it. And that, I think, is a really alarming thing, is, you know, it's one thing to call out people for any number of infractions, but if they have no way to get back into, you know, like a right standing with their peers or with society, that's incredibly destructive. And I think that's something that I'm really, really concerned about.
My therapist is better than yours. She is. Hey, I asked her about anger before doing this episode, and as always, she's like a wizard. I call her Obi-Wan Kajaki. Her name's Jackie. You know Obi-Wan Kenobi. Well, she's Obi-Wan Kajaki. So check this out. Quote, anger is human and normal. It can motivate for construction or deconstruction. We feel a burst of energy with anger. Unexpressed anger can cause illnesses like depression and strange thinking. Righteous anger, good cause, good plan, has accomplished a lot, I suppose. But there is something interesting about anger. It's sprung from something else, not itself. It is always constructed on a foundation of fear. If you can state the fear, the anger will dissipate somewhat, maybe entirely, and then you can get back to your more logical and less emotional mind. It's the best anger management technique ever. If there is trouble finding the fear, here's a hint. There are only two fears. Whoa. Fear of not getting something we want, or fear of losing something we have, i.e., I'm afraid my friends will be hurt by racists. I don't want to lose my friends to violence. Or, I'm afraid my friends will never be woke. I want that to happen, and it's not happening. To feel the anger and simply state the fear brings us back to our logical mind, where we might be capable of coming up with a creative solution, and we get to the heart of the matter. We begin to deal with facts rather than pure emotion. Then we can formulate thoughtful strategy instead of coming out swinging. Oh my gosh. See what I said? See what I told you? My therapist is better than yours. All right. I have Brant Hansen and Jory Micah. Both of you guys have been on here before. Jory, you've been on here quite a few times. Brant, we were just talking, and we know that you were on here, but we don't remember what we talked about. That would normally lead people to believe that it wasn't anything special, but I don't air stuff that I don't like, so I know that it was good.
It was powerful, whatever it was.
It changed my life so much that I just kind of blacked out. Oh, man. Good, but good. Hey, I actually, it's interesting. Once in a while, our listeners will send me ideas for the show. And I typically look into it every single time because many times it's gold and then I'm very appreciative. But I had actually seen this latest book of yours on my own and I had been planning on reaching out to you. But then I had someone else reach out to me mentioning the book and I was like, yep, I do think it'll be a good conversation. So you wrote a book called Unoffendable. And I'm going to just go ahead and say, Brant, that if you get offended in this conversation, it's going to be really awkward for me and Jory. It's going to be really awkward,
ironic. It'll all be in there.
Right. I don't think you'll sell any books if you lose your cool. Oh, man. So, we are living in a day and age where people are just pissed. So many people are pissed. I just scroll through Twitter. And for me, and maybe it's the people that I'm following, it seems like most people are expressing anger more than anything. There's definitely been some people, and this is where I really plan on, I think, learning from Jory's perspective, because I'm pretty sure with what Brant is going to represent here, I probably fall in line with. Like, there's some people I'm just like, man, are they just looking for things to be mad at? And I feel like, is it healthy to be mad like that all the time? So I did an episode, it would have been episode 276, where I was definitely in the learning posture. It was Propaganda and Jamie Lee Fitch. And basically the question was, how do we love in this day and age? And I know Jamie's not a professing Christian, but we were talking about it from a Christian perspective. And one thing I had to take in consideration is my white, straight maleness, and taking that into consideration as to why maybe I'm not angry all the time. But one thing that you have said, Brant, I was reading through some of the promo and it says, it turns out that giving up your right to be offended can be one of the most freeing, healthy, simplifying, relaxing, refreshing, stress relieving, encouraging things you can do. It's a radical, provocative idea. We're not entitled to get offended or stay angry. The idea of our own righteous anger is a myth. It is the number one problem in our societies today. And as Dallas Willard says, Christians have not been taught out of it. So I want you to lay a foundation for Jory and I. And I think a good question to start with, what are the things that you're talking about as far as getting offended? I mean, are we talking about what people say publicly, like a tsunami hit a certain nation because of so many gay people? Are we talking about something as simple as someone cutting you off in traffic, or a black mother whose son was gunned down needlessly? Like, what are we talking about when it comes to being offended?
Well, it's funny, like, you're in Charleston, the woman whose son was gunned down, most famously shot in the back in a city park. I remember her reaction. She was a believer and she said, I can't stay angry because I'm a believer. And I thought that was really interesting.
Yeah.
It's fascinating, actually. And it's brilliant. Her willingness to forgive. I think harboring anger, I'm coming at this from a Christian perspective, but I was raised with the idea that there's unrighteous anger, that you need to get rid of that. But there's righteous anger and you're supposed to hang on to that. You should harbor that.
Right.
And I've always thought that was the case. And then I was actually trying to figure out, well, how long am I supposed to be angry about stuff and which stuff? Because there's so much injustice in the world.
Right.
It's unbelievable. I mean, you can pick a billion different things that are happening, not just in America, but all over the world. Things that are happening to me, things that are happening to people. Guy in Egypt, 62-year-old, was put on his knees and they shot him in the back of the head on video last week because of his religion. Like, how long am I supposed to be angry about that? So I looked in the scripture and I was trying to find it and I can't find it. Every time human anger is mentioned, it's not righteous. God's anger is righteous in the Bible. He gets angry. There's no doubt about it. And Jesus clears the temple, for instance, but he's sinless. So he can be trusted with anger. That's what Dallas Willard was getting at. The problem is we are so beset with cognitive biases towards ourselves. And the fact is, Jesus told this story about a servant who owed money, tons of it,
yeah,
and begged for his life. And God let him off, the God figure, the king, let him off. And then he turned around and wouldn't forgive somebody else. Well, as I was studying this, I couldn't find where righteous anger was. In fact, in Scripture, every time it's mentioned, we're supposed to get rid of it. It's never mentioned like it's a righteous thing. And there's so much opportunity in the Bible for that. And in fact, in James, it says point blank. Now, it's wisdom literature in the New Testament, but I'm taking it. It's there. It says there's nothing about human anger that brings about the righteousness of God. The point about injustice or how I'm supposed to interact with that is to be grieved by it and then to take action. But that my anger, if I call it righteous against other people, I'm actually not forgiving them. I'm harboring something I don't actually deserve because of my own status before God as a sinner. What I'm supposed to do is actually do things. And so I will say, when I've had discussions with people, it's interesting. I will happily do the Paul thing from the Bible where I'll put my resume up against anybody in terms of actually doing things. And I'll probably win that one. But I don't think anger actually helps our judgment. And I actually think it gives us a lot of selfish, a mix of motivations. What we ought to do, instead of saying, I can't do anything unless I'm angry, is wonder why. Why do you need anger before you do anything? It seems like a problem. And I'll say this too, when I've discussed this in Christian realms, that the arguments I keep coming, I'm always ready to be wrong. I mean, that's just reality. Like, I learn and grow. And in this case, I had to learn something new. And but when I have these discussions, I'm not hit very often with scriptural arguments.
Yeah.
What I'm hit with is half a verse. I get the same half a verse over and over and over from Christians, and it's Ephesians 4:26. I'm not a Bible scholar, but I do remember this. And it starts with, in your anger, do not sin. Mm-hmm. And people take that verse and say, see, that means anger is not sin. I'm not actually saying anger is sin. I'll get to that in a second. But I think that's interesting because they don't look at the other half of the verse. And I'll ask them, what's the rest of that verse say? They have no idea. Because the rest of the verse says, and get rid of your anger before the sun goes down. So the very justifying verse that we use to set up this idea that I am the arbiter of righteous anger, so I must be righteous if I'm angry. In fact, I'm more righteous the more angry I get, isn't in the Bible. 5 verses later, Paul says, get rid of all anger. Once again, it's always in the list of bad stuff. It's not a fruit of the Spirit. It clouds our judgment. It makes us feel morally superior to people when we are the ones who should be extremely humble. It doesn't mean there's no right and wrong. We have to combat wrong. We got to do it. Be willing to sacrifice ourselves to do it on behalf of other people. But it's not driven from a righteous anger that we bestow upon ourselves. So that's kind of things in a nutshell. I'll throw that out. I do think it makes life incredibly better. I think it makes us better people when it comes to fighting injustice. And I think it drives us to a humility in a lot of areas of our lives it's actually really refreshing.
So let me ask you a few things, and then we're going to pass it off to Jory, who is a biblical scholar. And
good.
My question for you would be, Brant, how would you, I hate using such extreme examples, but it's the first thing that comes to me. So let's go to the woman that you mentioned in North Charleston whose son was gunned down. Would you say that initially she's angry, she's grieved, she just can't believe this is still happening? Like, my gosh, when is this stuff going to end? And I never thought it would happen to my son. I'm angry and I'm hurt. But then as quick as she possibly can, let go of that anger, do something about it. And are we saying, like, would you take that verse literal as far as don't let the sun go down on your anger? Because I feel, to be honest with you, if one of my kids were killed, I think I would be angry the next day at least.
Well, I'm not using it to walk up to somebody whose son was just shot and said,
totally.
Hey, the Bible says, you don't even know who I am, but the Bible, like, so, but the wisdom is consistent. Anger resides in the lap of fools.
Yeah.
I mean, if you want it to live with you, you're a fool. If you let it sit on your lap, you're a fool. So this is the biblical wisdom. Now, it's also incredibly, again, freeing to not let anger control the rest of your life. And so it's in your best interest and her best interest. And if you've gone through something like that, I would expect you to be angry. I would expect me to be angry, but I don't want to dress it up, call it righteous, and carry it around for the rest of my life.
My
question would be, in return, and maybe this is fair or unfair, but like, how long do you think you're supposed to hang on to anger if somebody does something?
Right.
I'd love to know that. Like, how long? But until I apologize? Because a lot of people won't.
Right.
Because it seems to me that you are condemning yourself to something for an awfully long time. It's also horrible for your body, by the way. Physiologically, I get into the physiology of anger, and it's so deleterious. So what anger really could be used for is fight or flight. So it's that initial response that we're given, and it makes sense, but we're supposed to get rid of it quickly. This is why this neuroendocrinologist at Stanford, Robert Sapolsky, who's an atheist, by the way, but he talks about how you hold on to anger or worry, and we're the only animals that get ulcers. Nobody else does. We're the only ones that hang on to, because we think we should hang on to stuff, but other animals, you get fight or flight, and that is that response, that physiological dramatic change, all of the stuff that happens, your cortisol, your adrenaline, all the stuff that happens, the spike in blood pressure, all the stuff. Like, that's supposed to be in and out of your system in 30 seconds so you can get away from the tiger. But humans, we hold on to it. We think we're being wise. And even now we even call it righteous to hold on to it and boil. That's up to us. But I do think there's a better way. And I think the Bible's actually pretty consistent about it.
Yeah. So, Jory, I'll tell you that I would line up pretty closely with Brant. And I think the one thing that does me in when it comes to this is, honestly, some of Jesus's last words, and that is, and this is why I tend towards a little more universalism as well, because I think he makes very clear that there is some sort of innocence, at least from God's heart, that if someone is doing something and they don't know what they're doing, may they be forgiven. And I think maybe it would be debatable that some people know better, but bottom line is there is something to, Lord, they don't know what they're doing. Please forgive them. And that was an atrocious thing that was just done to Jesus, and he had all the right to be angry. So I think my position would be at least that's what we aim for. And Brant, you made it clear too that you don't have like this thing that you require of people, hey, you don't need to be angry after such a, totally, we're on the same page. Like, but I would feel that this is something that we would at least aim for, is Jesus's heart on the cross. But I'm really curious to hear what you think about all this.
Mm-hmm. Well, I agree with what a lot of Brant is saying, for sure. If you're holding on to anger for long periods of time, you know, it's definitely going to start breaking your body down. But at the same time, just to show you my perspective and where I'm coming from, I don't know if you guys grew up in white evangelicalism, right?
Yep. Me.
Okay.
Brant, you?
Yeah, you did too?
Right? Yeah. And I went through a lot of trauma in that. So that kind of shapes my struggle to forgive is kind of shapes.
Yeah, I was going to ask you where you're coming from, I guess, before we move on. Was anger something you deeply struggled with in your life? And is that why you've come to this conclusion? Or are you naturally kind of just a laid back, chill kind of guy?
No, I had to struggle with it big time because of the stuff I went through with my dad. Huge. And then also, I'm very skeptical about Christian claims or any claims, honestly. I'm hyper skeptical. So I became skeptical of this righteous anger thing and was trying to find it in the Bible. Like, where am I? Like, can I have this? And why can't I? So yeah, it's a huge issue. And I think there are plenty of white men. This idea that white men shouldn't be angry is like, you can find plenty of white men out there that justify their anger. So, I mean, that's pretty common, huh?
Yeah. So I guess what I've seen in the evangelical world with this topic, I've seen people preach on this, be unoffendable. But sometimes I feel like the way that Christians and evangelicalism anyway have practiced this is to become unattached. So yeah, it's easy not to be angry about injustices when you're completely unattached, you know, and I've even seen it with my own folks who still attend evangelical churches and have learned a lot about the message that you're giving. And they're not angry anymore, but they're also not doing anything about anything.
Yeah,
you know,
like
it's easy to not be angry if you're just completely unattached to the fact that, you know, police brutality is happening, that, you know, all these things around us that are injustices in our lives and the marginalized and the oppressed life. Like, my concern would be, how do you teach people not to, I don't know, maybe you address this in your book, how do you teach people this concept without them unattaching and just being like, I'm not angry about anything, so I don't have to care?
Yeah,
because honestly, Jory, that's a bad look for the world. Like, and what I mean by the world is anyone outside of anyone who doesn't see themselves as a Christian. If they look at a Christian and they don't see anger at what's going on in society, or like you said, they just kind of a disconnection, that's not a good look.
I think it's a bad look if they, I think it's a bad, it's a bad look if they look at us and we just deal with anger the same way they do.
True.
They have no answers for it. And I don't think you could say, well, I'm not angry anymore. That's, I don't care. Like, I don't know anybody who's not angry.
Yeah.
I don't know. Your parents may not be angry about police brutality, but they might be, they're angry about something. Yeah. And people feel aggrieved all the time. That's our default setting. We, since Cain and Abel, like, we feel aggrieved, we feel jealous, we feel slighted, we feel, from start to finish, that's the way people live their lives. Like, there's, you can do that all day long. And every time you can be like, oh, I'm right, so I should be angry about this. So, I deal with the personal stuff. I also, in the book, spend a chapter on this, just quoting Dietrich Bonhoeffer and Martin Luther King Jr., who both have the same viewpoint that I'm coming from. And that doesn't make it right. But Martin Luther King right. Jr., literally his house is firebombed with his family in it, and he says he can't hold on to anger. Partially,
I'd say those two guys definitely help your case, though.
Well, I'm not a complete nut. It's certainly not unprecedented for somebody to say there is no actual division for human anger into righteous and unrighteous. Again, yeah. I would want somebody to say, okay, police brutality, what can I bring up some issues globally? Because I work with a global hospital network with kids that have correctable disabilities, and they're in all these other traditional cultures. They're in Muslim cultures. Can I be angry about all their stuff too? And why aren't you angry about it?
Right.
Yeah.
That's the other question I have. Like, why is it just your stuff? And how about we act to correct injustice, but we don't have to hold this moral authority where we're better than other people. That's why we're entitled to this righteous anger. Because that's really what I'm saying. Forgiveness, working in tandem with actually doing things, is actually a really powerful way to live.
Okay. So do you think that that anger is a part of grief?
It can be. I would think so. Yeah. I mean, it's certainly the Kubler-Ross idea, right? I mean, you go through that. So, yeah.
So how do you just decide, I'm not going to be angry? You know, like,
that's a good question.
How do you decide?
It's a good question. Okay, so this is a process, and I think the process is called discipleship. But the process is, I am a sinner, and I have to live with that God has forgiven me, and I have to extend that grace to other people. It's hard.
Yeah.
It's excruciating. But excruciating, middle word cross there, like, that's picking up my cross every day. And what happens is I teach myself this, that I have to live in that sort of forgiveness, the Jesus way of forgiveness. I start to become a different person where actually I do get bugged a lot less if somebody cuts me off. I'm existing in this world now of, I know we're broken. Nobody has to tell me the world is broken. I'm not going to be shocked by the same thing over and over and live in constant boiling anger that short circuits my judgment. Like, that's the thing. So I want to teach myself over and over to bring that to mind. And it's like N.T. Wright said about Jesus' vision for the church. He said he envisioned small communities of people practicing his way of forgiveness. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, that's a great vision for a church, like where we're actually helping each other forgive, working past this stuff and living as different sorts of people. Mm-hmm. And I think what happens is I've actually become more clear-minded to do the work of justice, to do the work of setting things right. But I'm not gonna call my anger righteous because I'm too biased. I'm not a good arbiter for that sort of thing. And then I don't know when I'm supposed to put it away. And then I look through the Bible and there's all this wisdom literature. It's like, I need to get rid of it. And there's all this literature about defending the fatherless and the widow and the orphan and the oppressed. So,
You know, what's interesting is I think that for me, there is somewhat of a difference between like anger in your own life context. So, for example, the young man who is trying to forgive his father for being abusive his whole life. I think most people in the mental health profession, as well as spiritual leaders, would say, look, you got to let go of that. It's going to eat you alive. It's not going to be good for you. You got to get rid of that somehow because it's something that's hurting you. It's not hurting your father. It's hurting you. There's that kind of anger that I think we would all agree needs to be let go of, but then also we're talking through the social justice sorts of things. And Jory, I think we probably see similar tweets and similar people. I think there's some overlap with folks who we interact with. And one thing that I have seen is that when anger is the prevailing notion and the prevailing lead-in with what people are thinking and saying, I think that it clouds people's ability to humanize. What bothers me, I think, is when I see Christians or people who profess to be Christians, and it feels like their approach is, I'm angry, I have a right to be angry, and I'm leaving that love thing alone for right now. Because I'm pissed. And that's where I feel like I have been okay with saying, you know what, I've got a lot to learn, but I'm parting ways with that. Because if I let go of loving or even trying to love in the worst of circumstances, I feel like I'm walking away from maybe the crux of our faith.
Bingo. Mm-hmm. I think that's it.
Yeah. So just a few things. I agree that, you know, we are, that there is like this, you know, forgiveness is at the end of the cross, you know, so that obviously is what we have to come to, you know, in order to be healthy people, in order to be spiritually well and physically, mentally, and emotionally well too. But I would be cautious to say that it's like, I find more humanity sometimes in people that are like, damn it, I am angry about this, that can admit it, that can come forward with it, that can say, you know, I'm mad about this thing or whatever. Instead of what I've seen throughout my life is a lot of just everyone's angry, but they're just suppressing it so that when, what I've seen happen a lot is people will suppress their anger their whole lives or whatever for years. And then all of a sudden they're exploding over things that seem very small, seem not worth that sort of anger. And the reality of the situation is that they have not admitted to themselves that they are angry.
Can I talk to sure.
Go ahead, Brad. I'm sorry.
No, it's a great point. I just wanted to talk to that. Like, I'd like to propose, because I do understand that, and I'd like to propose a different idea, and that is rather than suppression or expression. By the way, you can study psychological studies about venting anger, how it's, you know, we all think it helps us to go into one of those anger places and hit a lamp with a baseball bat and scream our heads off for 20 minutes and you pay them 20 bucks. You walk out angrier than when you walked in. Venting, there's no psychological basis for venting helping. If I go to Starbucks and complain about all the stuff I'm mad about, I will walk out more agitated. And I'll actually work up myself like a cheerleader, work myself up into more anger. The suppression is bad too. I'm suggesting forgiveness in a long-standing grief for the way the world is and how messed up we are, and understanding that's where we are. Entering into that, I have to forgive you because of what God did for me. I have to let it go. That's the only basis for it. Without that, I'm messed. Like, but neither suppression nor venting gets to forgiveness, which is the only way out.
I don't think you can just let it go like that. Like, unless I just feel like that's not human. Like, yeah. I just feel like you can't just decide, I don't want to be angry anymore. Like, it really does.
Right.
I really do think you have to process it with someone, maybe not the person at Starbucks.
It is, right.
With a counselor or something like that.
Agreed. But here's the thing. You have to have an objective of getting rid of it.
Sure.
That's all. Yeah, that's all I'm saying. Cool. That's all. That's all I think Jesus is saying. Like, when we have to love our enemies, we have to forgive as we've been forgiven, or we won't be forgiven. He said. I mean, that wasn't a subtle theme. Yeah. You'll be whatever measure you use for other people, it'll be measured to you. Like, you're charting your own forgiveness here. And is Jesus being toxically positive? I don't think so. I can understand if I went up and somebody just got a relative shot and I shoved the Bible in their face and I was like, hey, Jesus said you have to forgive right now. Like, yeah. that's ridiculous. And I'm not going to do that. And I understand we are human, but what I'm saying is we're not entitled to our anger. One guy I used in the book, because it was such an extreme example, and he's such a cool guy, is Sukriksa Him. So he's a guy in Cambodia. His family, I mean, this is an extreme example. Family of 12. They're all lined up by the communists. They're all lined up along a ditch and hacked to death with machetes and hose. They're thrown into a hole together and buried. Well, he just barely survived. He's one of the kids. He's in there with 11 dead bodies, his entire family, digs his way out at night and swears when he gets to be an adult, I'm going to kill each and every one of these guys. And then he becomes a Christian and realizes, I actually have to forgive them. It doesn't make it wrong or right. It's not about abandoning the idea of right or wrong or justice or anything. But in his heart, he realized that that was part of following Jesus, was like, I don't have a choice. This is the guy I'm following. And I thought that was so interesting. It's such an extreme example, but I realize I haven't gone through that. But he at least realizes he has to work through this because of who he follows. That's all.
Brent, yeah. did I hear you say correct? Did I hear you say that only God can have righteous anger? Like, righteous anger, as far as like a permanent attribute, that's a God thing, not a human thing.
Biblically, I can't find a basis for human righteous anger. I just can't find it.
Yeah. Yeah.
What about the prophets?
Yeah. Yeah. Like, God is speaking directly through them and saying, this is what I'm going to do. And I also want to gather you like chicks under the hen's wings. And like, there's this unique, like, I actually feel like I'm kind of that way. I speak to Christians and I say a lot of hard things, but I don't think it's from a place of I'm angry because you're a sinner and I'm not, or you're worse than I am or whatnot. So I don't know.
Mm-hmm. What about Jesus flipping that shit in the temple?
Yeah. You know, interesting about that is that comes up a lot. And first of all, I'm kind of like my belief, because I'm a believer in this Christian story, is that Jesus was sinless, and he also goes and dies for those people like 2 days later, whatever it was. So if you're prepared to do that for those people you hate on Twitter, I think that'd be really interesting.
Well, can we just talk a little bit about that situation, just to go a little deeper into
yeah.
it?
Mm-hmm.
So Jesus was flipping the tables because they were oppressing people. A lot of people that were already poor. For example, they were selling birds. They would sell these little birds in the temple in order for the poor to sacrifice.
Right.
And they and so that's why Jesus gets mad. You know, Jesus gets mad because they are turning his father's house into a den of thieves. You know, they are turning it into that is not Christian or godly or holy at all. And so his anger expressed in that moment is sinless, because his intentions were not to harm or hurt anyone, but to defend the least of these in that situation. So how, I guess what I'm asking, if we are called to be like Christ, of course, most of his life was love. Most of his life, that's the one example that we see him getting angry. So it's not, I agree with you.
Yeah.
But at the same time, Jesus showed us that sometimes there is righteous anger. And that's what he did in that moment.
I think the thing about him is we can trust his judgment of what is righteous and what's not. I don't think we can trust ours quite like that. I think I'm a mixed bag of motives, honestly. Mm-hmm. I really do. And I think that even when I do something that looks really cool and awesome and humanitarian and everything, there's still a little bit in there of me that's maybe a lot that's like mixed.
But how can we say that we can't follow Jesus in certain areas?
No, we can. Well, okay, so in Revelation, he's coming back to on a horse and everything, and he's got a sword, and he's like, so, okay, that's he's entitled vengeance, too. Like, vengeance is God's alone because we trust his character with it. There are certain things that are God's alone that we're not entrusted with. And again, the Bible's so consistent about it. It's not like there's a whole lot of nuance about this. It's literally like, get rid of all anger. There's nothing about your anger that brings about the righteousness of God. And it's, again, posited based on this unmerciful servant story. Where in the unmerciful servant story, I'm not the king. I'm not the guy at the top. I'm the guy in the middle who's been forgiven. So I don't think I can say I forgive somebody and simultaneously keep anger against them or that I'm entitled to anger.
Yeah, I don't think it would be keeping anger against, because I don't see Jesus keeping anger in that situation. I do see anger, though.
Yeah, I do, too. I do, too. No, definitely there's anger there. And God is angry in the Old Testament and then in Revelation. Jesus is angry with churches. I mean, he's like, there's definite anger there on God's part.
I really appreciate where you're coming from the perspective of like everything being like cancel culture and everybody's trying to cancel everybody. And those things are usually very silly and not worth our energy. But I do think there are some injustices where, yeah, like I might come at it with a biased approach because I'm human, but would it be better for me to just be unattached?
No. The thing to do would be to do something about it, but not to pat yourself on the back for tweeting about it. I'm all about doing stuff.
About it would be, you know, like I'm an author, I'm a writer, I'm a person with words.
Okay.
You know, so they don't get anything in real life. But at the same time, I think tweeting is doing something.
It probably is. I think there's something to that. But I also, you know, that that's just virtue signal times a thousand.
For me, it's not, though.
Okay.
But you get
credit for it from your view.
For me, it's truly brokenness over the way things have gone and trying to work through those things and trying to forgive and trying to understand. And
no, I believe
it's not virtue signaling. It's not at all.
Twitter in general is what I'm talking about. Like the temptation to pose publicly, left, right, up, down, whoever you are, and get your fans to go right on. Like that's just human. Like, so I'm contrasting it that way. Also, I know anger travels better on Twitter. There have been studies done about that. You'll get more retweets if you're angry about something than if you say something that's gloriously, joyful and true. That's just the way we work. We humans, we like that.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, you know, with the virtual signaling, I for the most part agree with you, Brant. I definitely see Twitter as a big game, and people are trying to get likes and attaboys and all that stuff, but there's more nuance to it. Like that is a very critical perspective for me, and I need to be a little skeptical of my skepticism, because I would see Jory as someone who we have people that we care about of other colors, and we've heard some of those people say, hey, you guys need to speak out, like y'all are white, please speak out. And I could see Jory, for instance, tweeting about injustice because she feels convicted. And it's like, hey, I have a little bit of a platform here.
Yeah,
I want
that makes
to
sense.
Support people. Like, yeah. I want to express solidarity sort of thing.
That makes sense. I guess what I'm trying to say is it's easy for me, let me put it this way, and to be angry, tweet, and then feel like I've done something about it.
Sure.
In fact, I referenced one of the study. I think it's a study in the book about that. Like, we do this thing where we feel like we've actually done something. We just check it. See, I just said something. Well, yep. Okay. Then we feel like they actually found that there's an inverse relationship between saying something actually and then following it up with making a donation or giving, like, cause you feel like you've done your thing. I'm not saying that's you and it's certainly not everybody, but that is a problem that we struggle with in an era where that's considered righteousness. Right.
Yeah. And even just giving financially would be considered a self-righteous thing.
Could be. All of it can be. Everything, every good thing you do can be because we are, it's like Jonathan Haidt said, again, atheist, New York University is like, we are self-righteous machines.
Mm-hmm.
And we are so capable. Again, Daniel Kahneman wins a Nobel Prize, cognitive biases. Humans are so beset with cognitive bias. We fool ourselves every day. That's who we are. I find it really interesting that they agree with Jesus basically on that stuff. Cause that's, he's constantly talking about that part of ourselves. Like, so I just would say, I don't trust myself to be the arbiter of righteous. In fact, I think you're really smart and I like you. And I'm guessing there's probably some stuff we disagree on. You might be right. I might be right. But, and also we can change over time. There's a humility that comes with this unoffendable approach. The other thing I would say too is I'm not talking about cancel culture in the book or anything like that, actually. Mm-hmm. So I've actually made some people mad because they're picking it up thinking they're going to get a screed that agrees with them on how people should stop being offended all the time. It's so stupid. It's a bunch of snowflakes. And they're going to pick up this book and it's going to be like, yeah, that sock it to the millennials or something. And they're like, what the heck is this? It's about living a completely different way where I can be with my neighbors who are maybe Wiccans, to use an example from real life, who hate us at first and we love them and they can't resist us because of it.
I guess the only like difference in what I would say is that I don't know if I agree that there's never a time to be righteously angry. You know, like I see that throughout scripture to me, even though I get what you're saying from the literature and from, you know, it's continuously telling us not to be angry, but you see the prophets, you know, they're pretty angry, you know, at times. You know, they're and God and they're human. You know, God's using them and speaking through them. And when you're in this like super, when you're constantly injustice type work, it is hard sometimes not to be angry. But I do think you have to ask yourself, is this something truly worthy of being angry about? You know, but I don't know if there's never a time where it's good to be angry.
Well, I appreciate that.
Brent, we'll give you the final word here, if that's all right with you.
No,
that's totally fine.
You're awesome, A, and I love talking about this. We could talk about it forever. And B, I think Martin Luther King Jr. is just a great example.
You're
and
right.
People, great. And I read articles about it. He was an angry black man, and I'm like, actually, he said he eschewed anger, and then what they were like, well, did you read the letters from the Birmingham, you know, jail? I'm like, yeah. And they're brilliant. And they're very pointed, extraordinarily pointed and on being, and also unclouded by a fit. Yeah. He's making his point. That's and point. I aspire to do that too, to speak very directly and emphatically, but it's not out of anger. It's out of passion and love. Like, I love this so much. I'm not going to let you mess with this.
Yeah. I think it's a matter of figuring out the line between, because I feel like people call me angry all the time, even when they don't feel angry. You know, like I feel like that's kind of how I am. I am passionate. I am, you know, like this. So maybe it's finding that, how do we be confrontational without being angry?
Well, if you love those enemies.
What?
If you really love those enemies, I think that's a big part of it, because then a lot of that physiological stuff to that tension of anger that won't necessarily be there, because you're so rooting for this person you're talking to. And I get that impression from Jesus. Like, now, am I there? No. But I do think we grow towards Jesus. Like, we become, he can help us, and it's practicing the things that he gave us to do, like obeying his commands. We start to, that's what actually helps us go there. But anyway, awesome discussion. Jory, you're fantastic.
Thank you. It's nice meeting you, Brian.
Nice meeting you, too.
Yeah, so Unoffendable seeks to lift religious burdens from our backs and allow us to experience the joy of gratitude, perhaps for the first time every single day of our lives. Brant, congratulations on a new book.
Thanks, man.
Sounds like a doozy of one, and I think you really made a good case. And honestly, Jory, you brought exactly what I asked you to come here to do, so I'm glad. And it's always fun to spend some time with you as well, Jory. Thank you so much.
Yes, you too, Joey. Thank you for having me.